From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Brad Meltzer is 38 and the author of 6 best-selling suspense novels. They're what you might call potboilers or page-turners, and they include The Tenth Justice, The First Counsel, The Book of Fate. His latest book is The Book of Lies. One thread running through Meltzer's work is detailed research. He weaves in real events, locations, and life experiences. This time, he writes about the origins of that American comic book character, Superman. I asked Meltzer how he came up with the Superman story.
The story actually found me. I was at a book signing 2 years ago, and a woman stands up and says to me, "I know more about Superman than you'll ever know." And I think to myself, "Lady, there is no way you know more about Superman than I know." And she says, "Sure I do." She said, "Jerry Siegel, who created Superman, is my uncle." And she's the one who introduces me and takes me into the entire family and unveils to me this unsolved murder from 1932 that nobody knows about. I mean, it's known in a couple geek circles, but nobody knows this story. Because in 50 years of interviews, when they ask Jerry Siegel, "Where'd you get the idea for Superman?" he never tells anybody that his father died in a robbery. I mean, you create the world's greatest crime fighter right after your father dies in a crime, and you never tell anybody? And that's why the world got Superman, not because America's the greatest country on earth, but because a little boy lost his father.
Now, Mitchell Siegel was a haberdasher. Tell me about the circumstances of his death.
Yeah, the circumstances of his death, it depends who you ask. Half the family is told that he works in this haberdasher, that he's a tailor, and that someone comes in, pulls a gun, takes some clothes, and shoots him in the chest. The other entire half of the family will tell you that a man comes in, pulls a gun, asks for some clothes, but that Mitchell Siegel has a heart attack. There is no shooting. There is no blood. To this day, it doesn't matter whether he died of a heart attack or whether he died of a shooting. What matters is that Jerry Siegel's father died in a robbery. He died in a crime.
You know, people who follow Superman are sometimes obsessive about Superman trivia. So I'd like you to help me distinguish between the fact and the fiction involving the story now that you've actually dug into this. You went back to Cleveland. There really is a red and blue house back in Cleveland.
It's incredible. I said to myself, if I'm going to do the research for this, I need to see where Superman was created. It's in Cleveland, Ohio, and I go back to the house. I assumed it would be something out of a Norman Rockwell painting, that the apple pie would be right there on the porch. The place is a wreck, and I'm not talking about it needs a little bit of paint. It is has giant holes in the wall, holes in the ceiling. It's painted bright blue and red, real Superman colors. This is absolutely...
Who painted it, these colors?
The owners, I think, who are currently there, painted it Superman colors years ago. And you can't miss it. It's a rough place.
There are also interesting details in the story. There's one in particular that I loved. There's a search for a weapon. And someone goes into a series of fast food restaurants, and they go straight to the men's room, and then they sort of feel around inside the ceiling tiles looking for a firearm. And after a series, I think it's 4 or maybe 5 restaurants, they finally move a ceiling tile and they find one. And you write, "It's hardly a perk of my job, but it's the same in every crap neighborhood in America. Show me a local fast food joint and I'll show you where the kids are hiding their guns." Did you make this up, or is this something you tripped upon in your research?
No, I didn't make it up. That's absolutely true. I went out with homeless outreach workers, and I said, "I need to know how your job works." And I said, where do you find weapons? Where do people hide weapons? And they said, "Oh, go to Burger King. Go to any Burger King, go to any McDonald's in a bad neighborhood, go into the bathroom, push up the ceiling tile and feel around, and eventually you're going to find a gun. Because these kids can't bring them to school, they won't bring them home, and they need someplace to hide them." Put it right in the book.
Brad, when you talk about Superman, I see in here not just a 38-year-old man, but some shadings of an 8-year-old boy. You loved Superman, didn't you?
I loved Superman. I loved Batman. Anyone who loves these characters loves them from when they're a child. And I know that part of this is just me in some vain attempt to regain hair and youth. But it's what I love. And I don't love it because I just want to play with my action figures and sit in the corner and read my books like I used to. I love them because of what they say about us. The first morality tales we ever read are superhero comics. That's where you first see whether the good guys win and whether the bad guys win. And it matters. It shapes us as a society. If you look back at the Great Depression and you look at which comic strips were popular, they were Flash Gordon and Tarzan, characters designed to transport us elsewhere. It was the Depression. No one wanted to be in the reality. And then here comes World War II. America's scared and terrified, and suddenly Superman arrives, ready to save us all, takes off. Now, here go, we are in 9/11. Remember the first big blockbuster after 9/11? It was Spider-Man. Once again, we're a country that's terrified and we want someone to save us. Now look who we've nominated for the President of the United States. We haven't nominated politicians. We're looking for heroes. McCain is someone who has fought the bad guys with his bare hands. Obama is someone who's the great hope to half of America. This is all not coincidence. We are starving for heroes.
Brad Meltzer, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Brad Meltzer's latest book is called The Book of Lies. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. We begin this hour with politics and a closer look at the record of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. John McCain's running mate has been presented as a tough, independent-minded budget cutter, an ethics crusader, and a whistleblower who hasn't been afraid to take on the oil industry and leaders of her own party. She and John McCain have emphasized her executive experience. But her 20 months as Alaska governor tell a more complicated story. Elizabeth Arnold reports from the Alaskan Capitol on Palin's political rise and her record running the state.
While many here in Juneau are quick to say Sarah Palin is inexperienced when it comes to policy and governing, there are few who would say she doesn't have good political instincts and even better timing. She ran against the least popular governor in Alaska history, Frank Murkowski, and her campaign was simply that she was not him. It worked, and it became her strategy for her first year in office. She undid things he'd done, from putting his jet on eBay to repealing a surtax he put on tires. Then she took on his unfinished business, the still-yet-to-be-built natural gas pipeline, and the unfinished business of Democrats in the legislature raising oil taxes. Economist and columnist Greg Erickson says Palin has made her mark by taking industry on.
Some might say that the legislature itself played a big role in that, and that would be true. But I think Alaskans were pleased that they finally got a governor that would lead the state out from its 27, 28 years of dominance by the oil industry.
But Erickson's praise stops there. He says her single-minded focus on oil taxes and the gas pipeline have left little time for much else. He's heard any number of disgruntled legislators say her office has little interest in mundane tasks like getting control of Medicaid spending.
There are very few areas where she had any policy initiatives, and there are no areas that I can think of where any of those initiatives were carried to fruition.
So there's no laundry list of bills passed these 20 months, and Palin's not known as a consensus builder. In fact, she's more willing to alienate to get things done. In that sense, she is a maverick. One of her biggest detractors is Republican Senate leader Lyda Green, who's been unabashed about saying Palin isn't ready for prime time. Instead of working with Green, Palin allied herself with the Democratic minority in the House to advance the pipeline and oil tax legislation. House Minority Leader Beth Kurtula.
It never is just about one person. The credit that I give Governor Palin is that she was willing to work with Democrats, she was willing to listen to us, and she was willing to take our advice, and that she had an excellent gas team in place. But on other issues, she has not been so good.
While Democrats like Kurtula would like to see Palin spend more money on social programs, Republicans don't think she's serious enough about establishing fiscal discipline. During her first round with the budget, she angered both parties in a veto message saying someone has to be the grown-up. Her most recent round of budget cuts were called inconsistent, as she approved projects in her hometown but vetoed similar projects elsewhere as non-essential. Rebecca Braun is the publisher and editor of the Alaska Budget Report.
It's more that she's politically savvy than that she is a true blue budget cutter. Of course, during her time in office, we've had these unbelievable surpluses, so there's been sort of zero pressure to actually cut the budget and make those hard decisions.
As for being a true reformer, years ago Palin did take on her own party when few would dare and risked her political career in the process. But the ethics bill that passed the legislature this last year was more a reaction to the FBI-led corruption investigation than any effort led by Palin. Indeed, Palin herself accepted money from Vico, the company at the center of the scandal. Still, there is a new atmosphere in the state capitol these days, and Palin's administration deserves the credit. Clark Greening has been a lobbyist in Juneau for more than two decades.
There are fewer avenues to work on and less of the pay-to-play kind of thing.
Greening says Palin's declared that she will not talk or meet with lobbyists in her office, and she's stuck to that rule. But he adds with a smile, that doesn't mean she won't talk or meet with lobbyists anyplace else. In sum, Palin's political instincts, good timing, and swollen state coffers have ensured a relatively successful 20 months in office. And just as she was getting into trouble here at home for allegedly using her position to remove a state trooper who's in a custody battle with her sister, she was tapped as John McCain's running mate and whisked to the Republican convention. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Juneau.
Now a story about reggaeton and challenging stereotypes. Reggaeton is a blend of hip-hop, reggae, and Latin rhythms that, like some rap music, has been criticized as violent and misogynistic. But some performers are winning praise for celebrating their African heritage. Enrique Rivera reports on one musician who's trying to bring social and cultural consciousness to reggaeton.
Tego Calderon has shattered reggaeton stereotypes. Through an assortment of Afro-Caribbean rhythms and sharp social commentary, the rapper has transformed the way many young people see themselves.
I started to do music for my black people so that blacks can feel proud of being black.
I want to stay black because this color is beautiful. That's something rarely heard in Latin America, a region with a long history of racial denial. Roland Roebuck is an Afro-Latino activist in Washington, D.C.
The definition of race in the United States is very different from the definition of race in Central and South America. In our respective countries, there is this notion that we are not black. We are a nationality.
As an example, Roebuck talked about a recent trip to the Dominican Republic.
And I saw an individual, he was sort of a policeman of my complexion, black. And I asked him, why are you holding that stick? And this area is called the Jabón, which is near the border with Haiti. And he said, this is to beat the black Haitians. This is to beat the black people. So I said to him, well, you should take that stick and you should start beating yourself because you're black. And he said, no, I'm not black. I am Dominicano.
While that attitude is common among Afro-Latinos, Tego Calderon says he was lucky.
Sí, no, yo gracias a Dios, pues mis papás son gente que son pro-negro.
Yeah, thank God my parents are people that are pro-black and are also for the independence of Puerto Rico. I grew up in a house that is very different than others, and I don't blame people that feel the way they do because they have been sold this. This has been passed down from generation to generation.
To pass a new message to his generation, Calderon often shouts out Africa in his songs. Today, it seems like Latinos are embracing this side of their heritage, says Zeta Rivera, former editor-in-chief of Urban Latino magazine. She's now a columnist for the magazine and website, Diversity Inc.
The funny thing about it is that I think music has such a big part in it, like Tego Calderon. A lot of people didn't even know that Puerto Ricans look like Tego do. And when he's there, he's so prideful of that. He's so prideful to say, soy negro. If you really listen to his lyrics, he has such political messages. He talks about culture. He talks about us bringing everything together, not always being at odds with each other, but at the same time, he still got his fro, he still got his dark skin, and he finds beauty in all of that.
But activist Roland Roebuck says music is one of the few places where you do see this type of representation.
Afro-descendants or Afro-Latinos are given space in three main areas: music, entertainment, and sports. But if you try to identify Afro-descendants or Afro-Latinos in the areas of commerce or the judicial system, institution of higher learning, you will find a serious, serious absence.
Latinos that have African features were tired of not being able to claim their pride and to claim their roots. And, you know, we're tired of being told they weren't as Latino as everybody else because they looked African.
Besides being a rapper and a singer, the New Yorican performer, who goes by the name La Bruja, is also an actress and a poet. Her Her most popular poem is called I Too Am Black.
Although you may find me fair, with medium brown eyes and not too curly hair, of mixed heritage, too many to name, one thing was the same, we've all shared despair. Believe it or not, in fact, I too am black.
Tego Calderon says he strongly admires many African American leaders, so much so that he even named his son Malcolm X. He said that Afro-Latinos need to learn a lot from the African-American community in the United States.
This is a struggle. I think that at least in Puerto Rico, black people need to get together and demand our rights, just like Martin Luther King and the NAACP did. Because if you don't demand your rights, nothing happens. So I think it is time that we tell the politicians that we are a force, that we are many, and that we need to be given our place in society, and that we demand our respect.
With multi-platinum sales, Tego Calderon has certainly earned the respect of the marketplace. And with popularity comes attention, and with attention comes the possibility of change. For NPR News, I'm Enrique Rivera.
Salpica, salpica, dale pa allá. Se acabó la salsa monga. Changuería en pote.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It was a sadly familiar scene yesterday at Willoughby South High School in Willoughby, Ohio. A young man walks down the hallway with a handgun. Shots are fired. Students and teachers hunker down in their classrooms and pray the door locks hold. But instead of running away from the student with the gun, two men, Principal Paul Lombardo and Assistant Principal Jeff Lyons, confront him. Not physically, they confront him with words. Earlier, I spoke with Assistant Principal Lyons. He told me that when it all began, he and Lombardo were in the office, taking care of some routine business.
The first thought that I had was I heard this pop and then a window break, and I thought somebody thrown something through a window or what have you. To be very honest, I did not recognize it as a gunshot right away. When I saw people scrambling a little bit, I use the analogy, you look at firemen, for example, when everybody else is running out of the building, they're running in. Well, when we hear a noise like that as administrators, you know, whether it be training or something that just comes a little natural, we run toward the noise and say, hey, what can we do to help? And we did find that there was a young man that had moments ago fired a shot through the ceiling of another part of the school, made his way down the hall, and then did in fact fire a shot through one of our trophy cases that is in our main lobby.
And that was the glass that you heard
breaking. That is correct.
When you first spotted the student, what was he doing?
Well, we came to understand that this is, you know, obviously a young man that was pretty troubled, and at the point that he shot through the trophy case, he started to make his way down, you know, one of our hallways to an open area, which is basically our school commons near our cafeteria area. And Mr. Lombardo and I followed the individual down the hallway and, you know, just hoped and prayed for the best possible situation.
You say you followed him down the hallway. He was walking and you were just
walking
a few feet behind him?
And he did have the gun. In the young man's defense, he did not point the gun at anybody else, but he did in fact point it at himself. And our gut told us that the young man did not want to hurt us, but he may in fact be, you know, ready to hurt himself very soon. And that kind of enabled us to make the right choice to follow him down and see if we can't make the best of a poor situation.
And you tried to engage him in a conversation. You talked to him.
We did, as a matter of fact.
What did you say to him?
The young man said some things that talked about, you know, my life is going to be terrible from here on. My parents aren't going to talk to me. The things where he just alluded to what a rough time things were going to be from there on out. So our thought process as administrators was we need to first let this young man know that we care about him, that we're there for him. The panic mode did set in a bit, but we then said to ourselves, you know, what are we going to do to keep this young man safe? The line of questioning then turned into, you know, how old are you? once I heard that he was not 18, he is in fact a 15-year-old, I went, okay, now we're looking at what we're going to tell him with regard to how they're going to handle him as a juvenile with respect to legal ramifications. And we were able to, you know, tell him that he's got a lot of life ahead of him and he can work his way back from this.
Did you get a sense that you were getting through to him?
We did. And again, so much of that is just a gut feeling. I've spent 15 years in the classroom, and Mr. Lombardo has had considerable time in the classroom as well. We get to know kids pretty darn well. My gut told me again that he didn't want to hurt me, so what can we do to help him? And I asked him, I said, the kids around here trust me. Do you think you can take me for my word? And the kid was pretty good. He stepped up and he said, yes, I do trust you. I said, well, if you're going to trust me, you're going to need to trust us to be able to help you, tell you what's going to happen. If you go ahead and put the gun down, we'll tell you exactly how the police are going to react. We'll get you out of here safely. Please don't leave the decision in their hands.
The boy, and we should say that we're not using his name because he is a juvenile, he, as you said, at one point pointed the gun to his head, and he said he wanted to kill himself. And you shared with him a very personal story about suicide.
Yeah, there was a story that shortly after high school, I had a friend that committed suicide, and I will never forget the day at the young man's funeral. The mother looked at me and she said, Jeff, it is the most selfish thing anybody ever could have done. And I'll remember those words, you know, till the day I die. And it was just a situation where I thought for me to share that to the kid would be pretty effective. And apparently the things that Mr. Lombardo and I said to the young man worked out because, you know, we got out of there without anybody getting hurt.
He eventually dropped the gun and, as I understand, kicked it away toward you.
He did. As a matter of fact, the fashion in which he had done it was very slow and methodical, and it was one of those where you could see that the young man felt a great deal of remorse. He was apologizing. Please tell my classmates that, you know, I didn't want to hurt anybody. I wasn't going to hurt them. And, you know, at that point, he's taken the magazine from the gun. He's emptying the bullets from it. He cleared the chamber, placed the gun on the ground, and then kicked or slid it with his foot away from me. And at that point, I you know, asked him if I could approach him and, you know, asked him if I could walk him out and let him know what the police were going to do and to fully cooperate with them. And I gave my word that I would help in any way that I could.
Was it difficult for you to turn him over to the police?
Absolutely. I will say this. When the SWAT team came in and the local police, it is quite fortunate than living in the community. I probably knew half of the police officers out there. And these are guys that if I had kids, I would trust with my own kids.
Now, in this case, you ran toward the gunshot. School shootings have become common enough that most schools have some sort of training for how to handle them. In this case, did your training kick in? Did you actually do what you were told to do in a situation like this? Were you told to run toward the sound of the bullets to try to confront
someone? I can't say that anybody has ever trained us to run toward a gunshot. There was a great deal of strength in the idea that Mr. Lombardo and I were doing this together, kind of like one of those, you know, you got my back kind of things. To say we're trained to do that, no, and regardless of whether it was the most sensible thing in the world to do, to err on the side of, you know, I care about our kids and want to make sure they're all right, that's something I can sleep with.
Mr. Lyons, thank you very much for speaking to us. All the best to you.
I appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Jeff Lyons is the assistant principal at Willoughby South High School in Willoughby, Ohio.
Our book reviewer, Alan Chews, believes there's nothing more harrowing than a good old-fashioned murder mystery. Nothing except for two of them. And with these new novels, he found what he was looking for.
Harrowing is the best way to describe Donald Farr's new novel, A Common Ordinary Murder. Harrowing and somehow exultant at the same time. The main character is Police Lieutenant Stephen McCord, a district commander in a fairly large, unnamed Midwestern city. On McCord's radar is a particularly brutal murder of an elderly political activist and the ghastly rape and murder of the man's daughter. Lieutenant McCord painstakingly searches for clues and hunts for the killer or killers while his marriage seems to be falling down around him, mainly because of his own doing. His wife, Nora, is deeply Catholic. McCord himself is deeply enamored of an intensive care nurse from a local hospital. These two strands of the story work in counterpoint, and Farr's unusually philosophical approach to murder and sex and infidelity heightens the struggle almost to operatic intensity. With questions about religious faith, fidelity, wisdom, the nature of the human animal, trust, and despair on almost every page, the novel reads almost like a whodunit by the late Leo Tolstoy. If you like a little satire with your blood, I highly recommend the new novel by John Darton, a veteran New York Times reporter and editor with at least one Pulitzer Prize under his belt and many other accolades. Darton now writes novels. His latest, Black and White and Dead All Over, opens with a body on the newsroom floor of a newspaper he calls the New York Globe. This certainly can't be the New York Times, can it? The famous gray lady of American journalism, with editors and owners and reporters falling all over themselves trying to catch the killer of a much-despised assistant managing editor. It's certainly a funhouse mirror image of the Times, though. A very large cast of neatly edged newsroom characters make for a very large list of suspects, and try as I might, I couldn't identify the killer myself until the novel had almost fully unfurled. So, nothing much ordinary about this book, as Darton packs more than half a lifetime of newspaper lore into these blood-drenched pages. Now, how about this for a crime menu? Donald Farr's novel for the entree, John Darton's for dessert.
Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University. Those two novels again, A Common Ordinary Murder by Donald Farr and Black and White and Dead All Over by John Darton.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In Salem, Oregon, a mental hospital that became infamous because of a film is being replaced. The Oregon State Hospital was built in 1883. The movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was filmed there. The hospital, with more than 500 beds, had long ago fallen into serious disrepair. Dr. Marvin Fickle is a former superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, and he helped draw public attention to the many problems there.
The design was initially intended to allow sunlight in every room. But unfortunately, over the years, it got translated into a situation of small, dark rooms along a long, narrow corridor, leading to both a sense of institutionalization and lack of safety in many areas. If you look at that facility today, it is a fairly gloomy kind of place.
How do you account for the fact that, I mean, the problems at this hospital have been known for years? There was, of course, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975, which painted a picture of this place that was not at all flattering. But nothing was done, it seems.
It's not that people were not interested in getting things done. As we've seen in many other public infrastructure issues around the country, despite the fact that people are aware that there are problems, it takes political motivation, a tax revenue base which can support long-term requirements, both in terms of building costs and in staffing. So these things in Oregon led to a situation where the state hospital was relegated to a second-class citizen, if you will.
I was surprised to learn that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was filmed inside the hospital. They got permission to film there. What do you think about the movie?
Well, obviously the film is very dated. It was dated even when it came out in terms of what actually was going on in public facilities like the Oregon State Hospital. However, among what I consider the more important aspects of that movie was a recognition that sometimes people who had the very best of intentions did some things which were, by our standards today, less than appropriate. In fact, downright violent. I'm concerned that, of course, people who come after us will look at our efforts in the public health realm in the same kind of way.
Hmm. And with the groundbreaking today for a new facility there, what does this day mean to you?
I'm certainly very pleased that the state has finally gotten to the point where it recognizes that we need a new state hospital.
Do you think it'll be an improvement on what's there now?
That would not be difficult. The situation has been so problematic for so many years that certainly a new facility will allow, I think, a new emphasis on a treatment-oriented and community-based transition program that will allow people to hopefully return to the community better able to deal with the stresses of what's going to occur when they get out.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Fickle, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
It's Dr. Marvin Fickle, a former superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital in Salem, the setting of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.